so we will continue the discussion from last time where we were, last meeting, two classes, I mean, not the guest lecture, where we were talking about remote procedure calls. So I will, just to recap, we basically said the main goal of RPCs is to make distributed computations look like local computation. You still have your applications, which are now a client and a server application that is built as if it's a single logical application. You make calls to procedures. Some are local, like in normal application. Some procedures are remote. And when you have remote procedures, you send a message to the server asking it to execute the remote procedure and send you back the results. That's the basic idea. We talked about issues such as parameter passing. You know, like, you cannot pass pointers, for instance. We looked at how you can find the server and bind to it. Stuff that is done by the stub code that you don't have to write as a programmer, has written for you. And we briefly talked about failure handling. We will come back to failure handling in a subsequent class when we talk about fault tolerance. Okay. So what we'll do today is I'm going to talk about some special versions of RPCs, which are optimized for specific scenarios or those that provide slightly different semantics to the programmer. And then we'll talk about RPCs in the object-oriented world, which are referred to as remote method invocation. Okay? And we'll look at how Java handles it, how other systems that have this notion of distributed objects handle it as well. Okay? So let's start with this notion of special purpose RPC systems. The first one that we will look at is what are referred to as lightweight RPCs. So the motivation for lightweight RPCs is straightforward. In many cases, when you have remote procedure calls, the client application or the client process and the server process run on different machines. Okay, this is why it's a distributed application that is running over a network. But there are some scenarios where the client process and the server process may reside on the same machine. It may be that the client is local to the server, it's just making a request, we just decide to use the same methodology to make the request to the server. So in this case, when the client and the server run on the same machine, you can optimize RPC systems to be more efficient. Okay? In the normal case, if the local client makes a request to the local server, you still have to go through the whole path where you construct a message, you construct parameters, you pack them into the message, you send the message, as if it was going over a network, it goes down the network protocol stack, then the kernel realizes that the server is on the same machine. So the packet comes back up, it doesn't go out over the network, it comes back up over the protocol stack and is handed to the server. So you spend a lot of, effort in processing the packet to your network protocol stack when the server was on the same machine. So can you somehow reduce that overhead is the question. So lightweight RPCs provide you a mechanism to do that. So they are only used in the special case where the client and the server run on the same machine. Okay. So the question is, what could you do to reduce the overhead? Okay, so you know what regular RPCs do when a client makes a request, a procedure call request to the server. You construct a message, you send it over a network, it goes through protocol processing and it arrives at the other end. If the server is on the same machine, what could you do to reduce some overheads? Yes?
Could you use UDP instead of TCP?
Yeah, you could use UDP, which will reduce the overhead of setting up connections. That would reduce the overhead. Don't send it over the network. So yes, right, we shouldn't send it over the network, but in this case, it doesn't go over the network. It goes down the protocol stack as if it's going over the network. Then the kernel realizes that the server is on the same machine, so it doesn't have to send the packet anywhere. It just basically brings it back up. So that is true. That's already happening. Somewhere inside a hand up here. So the simplest thing you could do is not spend any effort on the protocol processing at all. Why send it down the protocol stack and bring it back up? Why not have some other mechanism by which the client could just directly invoke the procedure at the server? Okay. So if you remember two or three classes ago, I said there are two types of communication. Message passing, which is structured communication, and using shared memory, which is unstructured communication. So in this case, the simplest thing you could do is, rather than spending effort on protocol processing, have a shared memory region, which is a shared buffer. And rather than actually constructing a message and sending it down the protocol stack, you simply put a message into a shared memory region. You just write to a region of memory and tell the server, I need to make a request. Here is the request call. Here are the parameters. Just pick it up from this region and just execute it. Okay, now you have just simply avoided all of the overhead of constructing the message and protocol processing. You're simply using a buffer to send messages back and forth. This is unstructured because it's not a real message in the network set. You are actually sending messages by using a region of memory. Okay, so that's essentially what happens here. So you are going to use the same mechanism to export your interface and import interface, but you are going to use shared data structures to communicate. Essentially a shared memory region to communicate, rather than using the standard message passing paradigm for communication. So essentially, I'll show a picture in the next slide. Your question
is? At what point in the entire procedure does the system realize that the client and server are residing on the same machine?
Okay, that's a good, very good question. So what point in the processing pipeline do you realize that client and server reside on the same machine? So as we will see, there are multiple places you could do this. One is you do this at compile time. The programmer figures out that this special application is built so that the client and the server will run on the same machine. You use a compile time flag, which basically says don't use TCP IP, use shared memory, and the RPC runtime system is configured already to do that. The other way is you can do that dynamically, which many systems may not do, but some systems can figure that out. When you bind to the server, you say, okay, the server is on the same machine, so let's use this path versus that path. So there are many ways to build it. We are just talking concepts. In reality, you have to pick one of these. You tell the programmer, say, you figure it out. If you want to use a special case, you compile it in. Okay, or the runtime system will figure it out. It will check whether it's on the same machine and decide which of the two paths to pursue.
Yes. How will you address the server machine?
How will you address the server?
In the sense, you are sending some information to some memory location. So how will that be picked up by the server machine?
Okay. So question: how will that be picked up by the server machine? That's what we are going to discuss right now. So just hold off on that for a moment. Any other question about this? So we'll do the same thing like we had done for regular procedure calls. What we will do is now we will essentially put the arguments into the stack or a shared memory region, and then you will basically trap to the kernel. Okay? You will basically make a system call. And then what the kernel will do is it will do some memory mapping. So if this is not a pre-allocated shared memory region, it will take that buffer and make it available to the server on the fly. Okay? If it's pre-allocated, you can use the same region over and over again. In many cases, the client may be communicating for the first time, so there may not be any such pre-allocated region. So what you will do is you will take a small region of memory from the client's address space, and you will use what is called memory mapping, which is essentially a way by which you can take a region of memory and map it into another process's address space, so it becomes available. It's a way to share memory across processes. So you will essentially ask the kernel saying change the memory map so that region where the arguments are put are now available to the server, and then you will basically have the server process execute. It will pick it up from that region. It will process the procedure call. It can do the same thing to return the results. It can put the results in that shared memory region. And when the client resumes execution, the results are already there as if the process is executed. Okay. So you can do these perform these steps to execute lightweight remote procedure calls. Okay. I'll show a picture of this, well, not all of it, but some of it happening. So Solaris, which is Sun's operating system, now Oracle's operating system, was one of the first to implement lightweight procedure calls. They called it DOORS. It was a special version of a procedure call. So it was like opening a door to another process's address space, so you could take the arguments, execute it, and return it back. And you had to, in this case, do some special things. It was not transparent. Okay, you had to say, I'm going to use lightweight RPC as a programmer. Okay, so there was a special API call. So you could say, you could do something called a door call, which was essentially a way to call RPCs. And then the server could register a door saying here is a procedure, but it's a remote procedure except that only local processes can call it, not remote processes. Okay, processes on the same machine can call this procedure, but not processes on the other machine. So that's one way to do it. Okay. Another way to do it is, as I said, you use the same RPC library, but you use a runtime bit, which will allow you to figure this out. So you can do this at compile time, or you can have a configuration parameter which says when the server runs, should you basically use the lightweight RPC mechanism or the regular RPC mechanism. So you can do that as well. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay, so these are special versions of RPCs. You don't have to use them if you are willing to pay the extra price of regular RPCs. If you use regular RPCs, it doesn't matter where the client runs, whether it's a local machine or remote machine, it works exactly the same way. This is if you want to optimize your system's performance for special cases, you use these kinds of systems. Okay? That's one special case. There are other RPC systems that don't change the runtime performance over it, but give different semantics to the application or the end user. What we have been talking about so far is, I showed this picture last time, this picture here, is what is referred to as synchronous RPC. Right? Synchronous RPC essentially are blocking RPC. You make a remote procedure call, and the client will wait until the results are returned from the server. This is exactly what happens in a local procedure call. When you call a local procedure, you basically start executing the local procedure finishes, it returns, and then the callee will continue, or the caller rather will continue execution. So the caller is blocked until the called procedure finishes. Same thing happens in remote procedure calls. Okay, you call a remote procedure, you wait, and that's what is shown in this time diagram. This is the client, the black lines indicate executing, the dotted line indicate that it's blocked. Okay? So you're executing the client, make a remote procedure call, send a message to the server, server executes the remote procedure, sends back a reply. Until this point, the client is blocked, and then the client continues execution. Okay? This is referred to as synchronous. Synchronous essentially means blocking. Okay? Now, as you can imagine, there are other semantics your RPC system can provide. The first one would be asynchronous. Okay? In asynchronous, you make a call, and then you don't block, you don't wait for the results to be returned to you. That's what is shown here. Okay. So you essentially are client is executing, client sends a RPC call, okay, and then it only waits for an acknowledgement saying the call was received by the server, not that the call has been processed. Okay, all that the server has to do is say, yes, the message was received, and then the client continues execution. The server can then execute that call asynchronously. And the client does not block. Upon the execution of the call, you can send another message saying, here are the results of your call. This is asynchronous. Whenever we say asynchronous, think non-blocking. Okay? The client is not blocked. There are many different versions of asynchronous RPCs, and those are actually what I mentioned on this previous slide. The standard asynchronous RPC is the server sends back an acknowledgement as soon as a request is received, executes the procedure later. That's the picture we just saw here, where you just sent an acknowledgement saying the call was received. It's not yet processed. Default synchronous RPCs essentially use two asynchronous RPC calls, one for the original procedure, and the other is for the results to be sent back. There's another picture for it here. Okay. So this is default synchronous RPCs. This uses two asynchronous RPCs, one in the forward direction, one in the reverse direction. So here is the client, sends a request, gets an acknowledgement, continues execution, doesn't wait for the result. Okay, and then the client is executing, the server executes that procedure. At some point in time, it produces a response, okay, and sends the response as a reverse RPC call. Okay, rather than simply sending a message saying here are the results are actually sent as an RPC call in the reverse direction. Yeah, asynchronous RPC. So you send back a response, and then the client gets it and then sends an acknowledgement. Okay. So two RPC calls, so it's a default, referred to the default synchronous RPC.
Okay.
Yes?
Faster. Is the synchronous the same concept as the event-based mechanic?
Are you asking if asynchronous is the same as event-based?
Yeah.
Is that a question? So event-based systems use asynchronous communication. They may use asynchronous I/O, they may use asynchronous network communication. Here we are talking about RPC systems in particular, okay, rather than event-based systems. And RPC systems can also be synchronous or asynchronous. Okay, synchronous, whether it's synchronous or asynchronous simply means is what you're doing blocking or non-blocking. You can apply those to event-based systems, you can apply those to RPC systems. Okay? All that is basically says is whoever is making the request or generating the event, whether are you blocked until the event is processed, the call is processed, that's what it means. Okay? Same concepts will be applied in those cases. It's not exactly the same.
So you can use mechanisms other than the event-based mechanism to realize the synchronized strategy.
So this is an RPC system. There are no events here, right? You are making function calls. And RPC systems are equal methods or functions that are either local or remote. There are no events. You're simply right. There are no GUIs, no event, none of that. Right? So the question is, will the call block until the results are received or not block? That's what we tell you, whether it's synchronous or asynchronous. Yes, question.
But an event-based system can only use
asynchronous communication. Event-based systems can only use asynchronous. Typically, event-based are asynchronous communication, yes. So they use non-blocking communication as a non-blocking calls as a result. Okay. Any other question here? So there's more questions? Okay. So the last one is one-way RPCs. Here, the client does not even wait for an acknowledgement from the server. You simply send the call and you continue execution, which if you think about it here, while this message goes out, you just continue execution. You're not even waiting for an acknowledgement. So this is why it's referred to as one-way RPCs. Okay. Here, you at least wait to make sure that your request was received by the server. Okay. If you're using UDP and you're using one-way, you may not even know whether the server received your request because you did not even wait for an. If you're using TCP, then it's TCP's job to deliver your message. You don't have to worry about it. So one way is as good as this because an acknowledgement will be received but by TCP rather than by the RPC system. Okay, so that's the difference between synchronous and one-way RPCs. Any questions on this? Yes.
What would be the use case for a one-way RPC?
What would be the use case for a one-way RPC? So we will see when we talk about MPIs and message passing interfaces, there are many of these semantics. So as I was saying, if you're using TCP, there is really no difference from the application's perspective whether you use asynchronous or one-way, because you're going to get an acknowledgement anyway. So why get an acknowledgement with TCP and then wait for another acknowledgement? You can just let TCP do the trick and just do one-way. Okay. If you're using UDP, then this is better because one way is not even going to tell you whether the server received your request. So I think it just depends on which of it you use at the application level might depend on what protocol you're using underneath. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So next up, we are now going to move that discussion into the world of object-oriented languages and object-oriented systems. So we'll talk about how RPCs work in the object-oriented world. Okay, so in these scenarios, we'll refer to RPCs as remote methods, okay, because there are objects. Objects are methods that you can call on. Okay, so rather than calling a local method on a local object, we call a remote method on a remote object. So now the objects, the application has a set of objects. Some objects are local to your address space. Some objects reside in other processes. So you can call methods on objects that reside on other machines. Okay, that's the generalization of RPCs to the object-oriented world. Okay. We will see, like in most object-oriented languages, that the way this is realized is by separating the interface that the object exports from its implementation. Okay. There's an implementation of the object and an instance of the object that sits on some machine and the process. There's an interface that object exports that a client machine can, or a client process can import, and then it can call the methods on the object. Okay, so this is how we are going to use RMIs, and they are actually supported out of the box in Java, for instance. It doesn't look very different from how traditional RPC systems are implemented. The concept is the same. okay, there's going to be some stub code that is generated for you. So you, the programmer, don't have to worry about setting up the network connection and all of that. You simply have an object and you call a method foo. Okay? So you'll use the same syntax, like you are calling a regular Java method. It just so happens that this is a remote object and that's a method that's exported by the object. So now it's our runtime system's job to construct a message, send it off to the server, get the results for you. So you will write your code as if you're writing regular Java code calling regular objects or whatever language you're using. You're using Java as an example. Yes.
So how does it go about like actually getting access to those remote objects?
So how do you go about getting access to the remote object? That's the same thing, same kinds of considerations arise here. You have to somehow bind to the server. Okay, so when an object is remote, it will register itself with some naming service. Okay? When the client imports the interface, it will ask the naming service saying, where is the object? What process is it in? What machine does it reside in? So you'll get the IP address, you'll get a port where the object is listening to, and so on and so forth. And so when you make this call, it's the stub's job. The stub is referred to as a proxy, which is the same thing as a stub. So it's a stub's job to set up a connection to the object, and all of those things are still done the same way as if it's a traditional RPC system. Okay. So essentially, this is the picture. Here's your server process. That box is essentially an object. These smaller boxes are methods, and that gray box is the state of the object. Has local or private variables. Variables capture the state of the object. Here's a client. It is going to import the interface exported by the object. Those are all the methods that the object exports. Okay. And then once you have done that, okay, you will basically, you are able to call methods on the object. And then the stub will do the same thing. It will send a message to the server, get back the results. It will do all of the marshalling and demarshalling of arguments, converting it to an XDR representation. So this platform independence is achieved. You don't have to worry about, is it running on Windows, is it running on Linux, is it big Indian, little Indian, none of that you have to worry about. All of that is taken care of by the proxy for you. So rest of it is the same. Okay? The only thing is now you have generalized this to an object-oriented one. Okay. So I talked about the stub. So the stub is referred to as a proxy at the client, and it's referred to as a skeleton on the server end. They just are different names, they mean the same thing, they do the same thing. Okay. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it. So as you can see, you set up connection with the server, you ask the naming service, where is the server running, you set up the connection, you do what is called serialization, which is the same as packing the arguments and converting it into external data representation and so on. Okay. The only important difference, there are two important differences as we will see. One is you can actually, at least in Java, you can pass parameters by reference, which we had prohibited in the C and C++ one. That's the first difference. The second difference is you don't need to know the interface of the object at compile time or when you write the code. In the object-oriented world, you can dynamically import the interface and call methods on the object. Okay? So you can do the binding at runtime, even to the interface. Okay. So you don't need to know all of what the server exports when you write the code for the client. You can import it. And those are two important differences. We'll talk about each of those in just a moment. So here is some code that shows how the client locates the server. Okay. So there are two ways to bind to the server. One is called implicit binding. The other is called explicit binding. The only difference between the two is in explicit binding, you basically actually call, you use the bind call and basically ask the your underlying runtime system to go find the server where this object resides. Okay. In implicit binding, you essentially just call the method, that is a remote method, and the first time you call the method, the RPC system or the RMI system in this case will locate the server for you. Okay. So here you are essentially calling an object and you call a method on the object, and then the runtime system will figure out saying, I need to find where this object is. It will call the naming service, it will do all of the things for you. Okay. That's the only difference in some sense, whether you have a bind call in your code before you call the first remote method, or you just call the remote method and not even call the bind call. The system takes care of it. And which one you use depends on what language you're using and what the language requires you to do. Whether you would explicitly bind to a server or the binding will be implicit first time you call a remote method. Okay. Now let's talk about this notion of parameter passing. So as I already mentioned, this is less restrictive than RPCs. Okay. In RPC systems, we said you cannot call by reference. You cannot pass pointers because pointers don't make any sense in the address space of the server. You try to dereference a pointer from another machine, it points a local memory address which is meaningless to the server. Okay? In this case, what we will do is we will actually relax that assumption and we'll allow object references to be passed around. Okay? Now, what this will require you to do is essentially change network pointers. Okay? Because when you have a remote reference, when you dereference a remote object, you have to essentially change a network pointer. That's what it essentially means. Here's a picture that shows what is actually happening. Okay? Now in the Java world, this is what happened. If you call a remote method and pass an object, okay, as a parameter, if it's a local object, it's passed by value. Okay? If you pass a local object as an argument to a method, then you make a copy of that object and you send it over. Okay? The object is already remote, okay, you will essentially pass it by reference. Okay? You basically pass a reference to that object, so you don't actually make a copy of the object and send it over. You can chase that as a network point. And I should explain what this figure means. So there are three machines here. Okay. This is machine A. Okay, first forget about machine B, C rather. This is machine A, it has a local object O1. Okay, and this machine also has a reference to a remote object O2 that resides on this other machine B. Okay, so two objects, O1 and O2. O1 is local to the machine, O2 is remote to the machine. Okay. Now let's assume you call a remote method and you pass both O1 and O2 as arguments of that method. Okay. So you essentially call this remote method and you basically say O1, O2. Okay. This is local, this is a remote object. Okay. The way Java works is if the object is local, it will make a copy of this object and send it over as part of the argument. So when the remote method is called on this machine C, which is a third machine entirely, you will have a copy of O1 being sent over. Okay. And any methods on that object are now called on the local copy, not on the object, that original object. Okay. But when you pass a remote object, which is you basically pass a remote object that is already remote, so you essentially pass a pointer to the remote object. So now this machine also has a pointer to the same object. So essentially, remote objects are passed by reference, local objects are passed by value. That's the basic semantics of how objects are passed in Java. Okay. Now when you dereference, just one second, so when you dereference O2 here, okay, O2 will still point to that. When you dereference O1, O1 is going to make operations or call methods on this copy, not the original copy. So if the state is replicated, you change the state. Here it's going to only change the state here, not there. But when you change the state of O2, it will actually change the original state. That's really the difference between them. Yes.
Both the machines can simultaneously modify the object.
Okay. That's a good point. So I haven't talked about synchronization at all, which I'll talk about also in a moment. So question is, can both the machines change the state of object O2? Okay. Or what happens when one machine makes a remote method call on O2, another machine also makes a remote method call? Now you have multiple requests that are trying to modify shared state. Okay? This should immediately tell you you need synchronization. If you try to do something like this without synchronization, it's going to have bad side effects. Okay? So whenever you have multiple concurrent RPC calls or RMI calls that access shared state, you need synchronization. The same is true here, okay, which we haven't talked about. We will talk about that. Is this clear? So here you have basically allowed, I haven't said how you are going to chase a network pointer. We will talk about that in a subsequent class, but essentially what you have to do is not just give a memory reference. You have to have a notion of a network pointer, which is an IP address of the machine, probably a process ID, and a address within that process. That's essentially the complete description of what memory region you are trying to dereference. Yeah, because if you just say address 500, meaningless, because you don't know what machine, what process you are talking about. Yeah. So you have to say, go to this machine, talk, look at this process, and within that process, look at this item. Then you know what where O2 resets.
Isn't this, there are a lot of overhead because of passing object by reference.
Question is, there is a lot of overhead when you pass by reference. Every time you dereference it, you will have to chase a network pointer, which is expensive, which means you need to dereference something on a different machine. Yes, so you are getting more convenience, but then there is also more complexity. And you could have said you prohibit it, then you could never have basically have multiple method machines calling this remote object. But if you allow it, you have to pay for the price.
In the implicit case in the previous slide, how will you unbind from a server?
The implicit case, how do you unbind from the server? That's a good question. So there is no particular semantics associated with when you disconnect from the server, because you're not explicitly bound. So it is left to the implementation. You can leave a connection open for a certain period of time. If no messages are gone by, you tear it down. You can do any number of things as a system design. Unless the language requires you to do something, then it's left to the implementation. Any other questions here? Okay. So I'm going to show you a different system, which is not Java. It's a system called DCE, which stands for Distributed Computing Environment. It's a middleware system that's no longer in existence. This was a system that was built, let's say 15, 20 years ago. By Digital and IBM, a set of companies came up with this middleware system. The middleware system supported distributed objects. Okay? But it supported two kinds of distributed objects. And we'll see why they are there and what they do. Okay, one is referred to as private object, the other one is referred to as shared object. Okay? So here is the picture for private object, that's the picture for shared object. So private object basically says whenever you call a method foo on some object, that is remote, okay, when the call arrives at the server, you will instantiate a new version of that object. Okay, you will do a new on that class and you will create a new object. Okay, and then that method will execute on that object. And when the method is done, then you deallocate that object. So this is equivalent to having a thread per request model. Whenever a request comes in at the server, you start off a new thread. Okay, and when the request is done, you deallocate the thread. Okay? Here you are doing the same thing, except that you have a thread, you create an object, the thread operates on the object, and when the thread is done, the object is also deallocated. Okay? Now, as you can imagine, if you may now make multiple calls, on the, let's say there are multiple clients all calling foo, the remote method foo on the server, each of them will operate on a different object, okay? Because for each of those methods will be their own object instantiation or instance. Okay? So there cannot be any shared state in this case. Okay, so you basically create an object on the fly, you call the method, it executes, and then you deallocate. The other one is you basically have a single object. So whenever you call foo, it is going to always call that foo on that instance of the object alone. So multiple instances or clients can call foo, they will all operate on the same object. In this case, state can be shared. So you have to use synchronization. Here, no synchronization is necessary because each thread has its own object. You are not talking across object. Okay. So when you write your code, you have to decide what kind of object you want, private or shared. So your remote methods could operate on private objects or they could operate on shared objects.
Which one does Java implement? So the Java part.
Which one does Java implement? Java by default implements the latter, which is what we expect.
Yeah. If a client is changing, then the other client should also.
So you can think of when do you want to use this. So if you're doing simple HTTP request saying, go get me a file, okay, you don't care about whether it's shared or not. You can get your own instance, you just retrieve the file. It's an HTTP, processes HTTP request, retrieves the file and sends it back to your dump. Okay, now on the other hand, if you're modifying some state, say increment a counter or do something, you need shared objects because after if it doesn't make sense to use private object. So depending on the application, you can decide which ones to use. Okay, so coming back to Java, we'll talk a little bit about Java RMI, how it works in the Java world. Okay, who is using Java for the project? So most of you, I assume, will be using Java RMIs. Okay, so this is basically how it works, or you probably already know how it works. started. So your server that defines the interface and an implementation. The server program will basically create a server object and register the object with some remote object registry, that's your naming server. The client, or rather the client stuff, which is called the proxy, when you call methods, will look up the remote object, and then once you have done that, you're going to just call methods or objects that are in the server. So that's basically how your system will work. There's a server that has to bind itself to a naming service. The client will import the interface by looking up the remote server in the registry. Okay, you have RMI registry, which is the server side name server. You can use RMI compilers if you want to basically create the server and the client stuff. And the tools keep changing as new versions of Java come, but that's the roughly the way things will work in the Java world. Okay, so let me talk about a few other things here. So the question of synchronization came up earlier. So if you have multiple threads that are making requests on a shared object, okay, you have to use synchronization. So in the case of the lab, this could be as simple as an update came in for some score and a request came in saying what's the current score. Okay, those are all both shared. Now the score is your variable that's shared, this board. So you want to use synchronization to ensure that you don't read the variable while it's being written to, very simply. Okay. There are many ways to do this. Okay, what you do for the lab is your design decision. I'm just talking about how synchronization might work at different levels. So one is you do synchronization at the server end, which is the simplest. You define a lock in the server, or you can simply use the primitives that are provided to you for by Java. I presume you know that Java has a keyword called synchronized. Okay, if you simply stick the word synchronized in front of a method, then automatically a lock that is defined for it. So now that says that can only one thread or one request can access any of the method within a synchronized object, because the lock is already defined. So if you have a get score and a set score or some such thing and both are synchronized, then you do nothing. You let Java handle the synchronization for you. So that's server-side synchronization. Now there are issues which you don't have to deal with in the lab, but there are issues that say if you are now blocked on the server and the client crashes, then what should happen? You're basically trying to grab a lock, but the client has disappeared. It can be some problem. So basically, if you block at the server, the client can crash. You need a way to clean this up and so on. Again, you're not expected to do this in the lab. I'm simply saying if you're writing real application, you have to deal with the client has disappeared and it was holding the lock and it disappeared. And then what do you do? And then so you have to decide. The other way is you don't block at the server, you block at the client. You don't even let the remote method go to the server if you cannot first grab a method, lock on the method you're calling or lock on the data structure. Okay. So you'll block in the stub itself. This requires you to implement what is referred to as a distributed notion of a lock. Okay, it's the same thing, except that instead of having one centralized lock, you have a distributed implementation of the lock. Before you make the RMI call, you try to get the lock in the stub code. Okay? If the lock is in use, the call doesn't even go out. It just waits there. Okay? And once you get the lock, only then do you actually send the request to the server. And since you already hold the lock, there is no other synchronization to implement at the server. So you could implement locking on the client side, in which case it has to be distributed across all the client. Or you could implement it at the server side, in which case there is nothing to do at the client and you simply have the traditional locks implemented in the server. Okay. So those are the two ways you can implement synchronization in any RPC system. Is that clear? So we'll talk about, now I didn't say how to implement distributed locks. That is coming, the next chapter. Okay, we'll talk about distributed mutual exclusion and things like that. Okay. So that's a quick discussion of RMIs. I'm going to talk a little bit about sockets, which are Berkeley sockets. So anybody here using sockets to do the project? At least one person. So sockets are the lowest level interface you can use for communication. RPC systems, RMI systems, they operate at a higher level of abstraction. You don't need to worry about setting up connections and so on. But if you use you set up explicit connections to the server, you tear it down, you decide what messages need to be sent, and so on and so forth. So here is basically a skeleton that shows you how to set up a server and how to set up, rather, how to write a server and a client that use socket communication. Okay, so you essentially use the sockets, so this is C code. The similar stuff you can do in Java as well. You can do socket programming in Java if you want to. Okay, you can basically use the socket calls to set up a socket at both ends. You need a socket abstraction at both ends. Socket is essentially the abstraction that lets you communicate. Okay, it allows you to communicate using either TCP, IP, or UDP. Okay. So on the server side, you set up a socket, you bind it to a port number. Okay, saying this socket is going to basically be on this port. Then you start listening on that port, which means now you're listening for requests to come in. Okay, so you create a socket, you say this socket is going to, let's say, forward 80, it's HTTP port. If you're writing a web server, you create a socket and bind it to port 80, saying I'm going to listen, or this socket is going to accept requests coming on port 80, and then you start listening, which means you start waiting for requests to come in. Okay? And then the client also creates a socket. And what the client has to do is first connect to the server, explicitly set up a connection to the server. Okay, this is where the TCP/IP handshake will actually happen. A TCP/IP connection is set up between the client and the server. So you send a request to the server, and the client, the server is waiting to accept connection after it has started listening. You basically just call accept, and you wait for a request to show up. When the client connects, it will basically, the accept call will return. At that point, a connection has been established between the client and the server. Once this is done, then you can use read and write calls. Okay, you can use write to write to a socket, which is you're sending a message, and you can use read to read from a socket, which is you receive the message that came from the client. Okay. So you can use write to send a request, and then the write can be used at the server to send back a response. Multiple messages can be exchanged, and then you will use close to close the connection. So if you've done any low-level socket programming, you will realize this is the standard structure of any server. Clearly, the server will be long-lived, so this will sit in a while loop. Okay. Or you will create a new thread for every connection once you have a new socket connection.
Are there any advantages to using sockets over RMI?
Okay, question is, are there any advantages to using sockets over RMIs? So socket programming is low-level programming. So if you want to do something that is out of the ordinary, or you want to program at a much lower level because you want to construct the messages, you use socket programming. It's the same as doing assembly programming versus programming in higher level language. Right? So think of this as the equivalent of assembly programming in the network world. You're basically using the lowest level of communication primitives to have the client and server communicate. RPCs, RMIs do it at a higher level. They do use sockets underneath. Just as when you write C code, it does get translated into assembly code. But you don't do it as a programmer. Somebody else does it for you. The compiler, RPC compiler will do it for you in this case. Okay. Any other questions here? So the advantages is if you can be more, you can actually get rid of the entire overheads of the runtime system. In the RPC and RMI, there's a runtime system that is going to do extra work for you. You can get rid of it and you can do something more efficient if you want it to. But you write more code to do that. Okay. So, you already mentioned all of these calls. So, socket creates a new communication endpoint. Bind will address or attach an address to a local socket, that's the port number. Listen will say, I'm now willing to accept connection. These are all done at the server. And accept will block until a new request is received from the server. Okay. And then from the client side, you use connect to establish a connection. And then you can either use send, receive, or read, write. Doesn't matter. Both system calls are equivalent. Once the socket has been, connection has been established, you can use either of these two, send, receive, or read, write, to actually read or write data from the socket. Okay, so what we will talk about next is message passing interface. So sockets, as I said, are the lowest level communication primitive. There are many systems that have been written that use sockets to implement something at a higher level. MPIs are one, RPCs and RMIs are another. Now MPI is a runtime system that is developed for a slightly different use case. Yeah, RPCs and RMIs are designed for distributed applications. APIs are designed for parallel applications that run over cluster specifically. Lot of scientific applications, simulations that physicists may be using or astronomers use, they all have lot of data that is being processed in parallel. So the way they parallelize their application is they run it over many different machines over a cluster, and they want very efficient communication primitives. You don't want very high overhead because you want the application to be very efficient. So as a result, you program at a much lower level. You don't use RPCs and RMIs. You use socket type communication, except that sockets, as we have described them here, are used essentially synchronous blocking calls. Not every parallel application may want to use synchronous primitives. So what MPI does is it's a library that generalizes what sockets do into many different scenarios. Just as you had synchronous RPCs and then we said here is asynchronous one way and so on, same thing can be done in the socket world. Other than having blocking calls, you can have asynchronous calls, you can have one way calls, you can have deferred synchronous. All of those abstractions are actually implemented at a socket like level, okay, at that level of abstraction. So this is basically used by people who write scientific researchers or others who write scientific applications for simulations in large clusters, okay, where you want to communicate over very low sort of low latencies. Okay, it is not even required that MPI run over TCP/IP. There are MPI libraries that run over other protocols and even non-standard interfaces that may not even be Ethernet interfaces. Okay, but it uses socket-like abstraction as I will show you here. We'll come back and talk about this also in a subsequent class. But here are, just to give you a flavor of the different types of send and receive calls you can use. So you'll see that there are actually six different types of send for sending a message over equivalent of an MPI socket. So this says just append the message to the local buffer and return. This says send a message and wait for it until it is copied to the remote buffer. Meaning wait for it until the OS at the other end has received it. This version of send, which is SSEND, says send a message and wait until the receipt starts, which means the server starts executing and starts processing the message. This says this is the standard synchronous version, which is send a message and block until the reply is received. This is the equivalent of synchronous RPCs in this one second. And this says send a reference to an outgoing message. Okay, so the pointer will send a message. Okay, so you will see that you have asynchronous versions, you have even the one-way version.
Could you explain the difference between SSEND and SEND RECEIVE once more?
Okay, these two?
No. SSEND and SEND RECEIVE. Because SSEND is send a message
SSEND
and
SEND
is
send
a server start. Okay. So what's the difference?
So that's a very easy question.
No. It
is the SSEND and SEND are the same as what we saw here.
No, not SSEND and SEND. So in SSEND, you're like send up the client contacts the server and waits until the server has started executing. And
this is SEND RECEIVE. That is SSEND.
Okay.
Send receive means you wait for the reply. Okay, SSEND means you just wait for that the request has been received and I get an acknowledgement.
So the server is sending that. The server itself is sending some either an acknowledgement or
yes. The MPI library will send an acknowledgement.
Okay.
Right. So send receive is basically the same as RPCs where not same as RPCs. The semantics are same as RPCs where you are basically saying, I actually block until the reply is received. Here, I'm basically only send a message and I'm going to block until it has been received at the server, not that it has been processed by the server. It's just been received. Here, you are waiting until it's processed and the reply has been generated. You'll see that these two are equivalent to one-way RPCs, where the first one says, I just hand the message to the local operating system. I am not even waiting until it has gone over the network. The second one says, I will hand it to the local operating system, I'll wait until it goes over the network, and I'll wait until it reaches the OS at the other end, but not the application, just the OS at the other end. The OS will send me the acknowledgement. Here I'm going to wait until not only the OS has received it, it's delivered it to the server at the other end. Okay, so you are waiting for different levels of processing to have begun. Now you can, where would you use each, that is up to the application programmer. They have provided this abstraction. You, the application programmer, decide which of these do you really want to use in your scientific application. Okay. I'm assuming that most of the time you'll do this, which is the SIP straightforward case, you send a message, wait for the reply. Okay. If you're doing asynchronous, you may use one of these three flavors. Okay. Which one is, I think, really up to what or type of acknowledgement you want to receive. Okay? Any other questions here? Okay, you'll see that there are also two versions of receive. Okay, one is a blocking receive and this is a non-blocking receive. Okay? This, when you call MPI receive, you will essentially block until the response is message is received from the server. Okay? If you use I receive, it is basically going, it's like polling. Right? So you say, is there a message from the server? If the answer is yes, you'll retrieve the message. If it's no, you'll just come back saying there is no message. So you keep polling, has a message been received? If the answer is no, you go out, do something else, then you poll another time and so on. And here, this is basically how you write asynchronous application. This is standard blocking. Okay, you say receive and you can wait for an indefinite amount of time until a message is actually received. Yes, two versions of synchronous and asynchronous receives. Okay, synchronous and asynchronous sends are multiple flavors. And there are, receive, there are only two variants. Any other questions? Yes.
And synchronous receive, there is a possibility that it can wait indefinitely. So,
yes. Synchronous receive, there is a possibility you can wait indefinitely. This is the same as socket communication. The server can create a socket and then it can listen. No client is communicating, it will just sit there waiting for a message to arrive.
So
the same thing is true of receive, you can just wait.
Is there some kind of interrupt?
There is nothing in the plain synchronous, you will wait forever. If nothing is received, you will just sit there waiting. Okay, so it doesn't say I wait for 5 minutes, if nothing has come up, then return from the call. There is no such semantics here. Okay, so you just wait for as long as is needed. Okay, that's the plain vanilla. Now, you can do other things to, if you need timeouts and so on, but this doesn't provide you mechanism. Other questions? So, we'll wrap that up early so we can have a discussion on the lab. Okay, so we have about 15 or 20 minutes. I presume for those of you who are opted for the special projects, come see me. We'll talk about the special projects separately. This is the standard project. As you have probably read the project description by now, you're essentially going to be doing client-server programming. A few things that we have mentioned is we are not going to require you to use any particular programming language. You can use whichever one you prefer. We have not specified every single detail because we would like to give you some creative freedom of how you make design decisions. Okay, so we only provide a high level specification of what we would like you to do. Okay, and then a lot of decisions you make as the application program. This is very similar to what might actually happen when you write a real application. You're only given some high-level specifications, you're given the interfaces, and then you're left given some freedom to decide how you implement it. So the system that you want to implement is fairly straightforward. The picture here, which is essentially you have a server this is a server that disseminates scores for some sporting event. In this case, we said it's the Winter Olympics, but it could be this server. Okay, so it will keep track of scores of events that are going on, it will keep track of medal tallies and so on. And the client's application, which are tablet-like applications, are going to ask for these scores and they're going to be given the score. And there is another process that is going to send updates. Okay, so that the scores have to change, otherwise the system doesn't make any sense. Okay. So the update process will essentially send updates. Once the update is received, the score is updated to the server. All subsequent requests are going to be then given the newest version of the score. Okay. We assume that the server will handle concurrency, which means if multiple requests come, you will be able to handle them in some concurrent fashion. There will definitely be scenarios where an update comes and a request for a score comes that requires synchronization. So so that you have to implement some notion of synchronization as well. Okay, if you don't implement locking, then there's something wrong, because then you will not be able to prove that the code will work correctly. Okay, so there are two specific types of the sports code dissemination. One is client pull, the other is server push. We talked about both of these modes earlier. The client pull, the client always makes a request to the server and retrieves either the metal tallies or the score. In server push, we assume that you will register with the server at the beginning of, let's say, a score game. And then the server will push, every time an update comes from the system, the server will push the latest score to every registered client. So here is the latest score. So both of these have to be supported in the system. Now, the important thing is, because somebody had asked a question about this, this needs to be written in a way where the clients can run on different machine, the server can run on different machine, the update process can run on different. When you develop your application, presumably you will run develop it on a single machine, so they may all run on the same machine. But make sure that you haven't hard-coded something or made some assumption that will prevent your application from running in a purely distributed environment, where every one of those entities runs on a separate machine. There can be arbitrary number of applications, or other clients. Now, we said that when you start it up, you configure it so you know how many there are for whatever reasons, or start that many processes. But you should be able to change that and support 4 rather than 8 or something like that. So those, or don't make any assumptions where you can only support a single machine client, things like that. That requires you to run the client and the server on the update process and the server on the same machine. If you use standard RPC RMIs, that comes for you for free. You don't really need to do anything. But do test things out and make sure that it actually works. Because it's a very straightforward first programming assignment. We will build on this. We will make it, make the server replicated. We'll implement caching. We'll implement handling of server failures. All of that is coming in subsequent assignments. This one is very straightforward, just to get the ball rolling. Okay. So I will pause and see if there are questions on the programming assignment. Okay, the interfaces are already specified here. Okay, so you should basically use these interfaces for the client and the server to communicate. Okay, very straightforward interfaces. Any questions on this? Have people started? People finished? Okay. So it shouldn't take a whole lot of time, and as I said, you can decide whatever language you want, Python, C, C++, Java, any of that is acceptable. If you use some Windows applications, like something like Visual, C# or some such thing, let us know, because we will need to set up an environment to run and test your code. Yeah, for most other languages, we will assume that the standard tools will work. We will grade it on the EdLab. So the other thing you should check is, you will all have been given an account on our EdLab. So you should check that the code runs there. You didn't hard code the class path or some weird thing that will prevent it from running. So that's where we will run it to make sure it works. So you need to, not only, so the important thing here is your work is not done as soon as your code starts working. Okay, you have to do all the other things that a standard software developer needs to do, which is write a design documentation, document your code, also write some test your code and so on. Okay, we even specified, do some simple experiments to check the performance. You don't have to go overboard. But just try things out, say what happens when you try some scenarios, increase the number of clients and so on. So do run those tests and report what observations you see and so on. Most cases, your tests may not reveal anything interesting, because you run the client and the server on the same LAN, you won't see a whole lot of performance differences between 2 clients and 4 clients. But run them anyway. Okay, it is just for you to understand how these things actually run in the real world. Yes.
So we're doing
a
test, we just run one machine.
We said for at least one, you should use more than one machine. Okay. Do some tests on one machine, but just prove to yourself and us that it will actually work with more than one machine. For that, you can use your EdLab. You don't expect you have 2 laptops or something like that. You can run something on the EdLab and test on 2 machines there. Okay. Subsequently, we'll also let you run things in the cloud, okay, in the subsequent program. I will not know. Everything clear? Okay, so there are no questions. I stopped the lecture early thinking there will be lots of questions. But so if there are no questions, we can stop here. You are always welcome to come talk to us. Assuming more questions will crop up for subsequent assignments. This one is somewhat straightforward. Okay, so we'll end here today. Just a reminder, there is a makeup class this Friday. Okay, because we did